Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. At the end of Chapter 5, Carla and her companions had started up the road to the Abbey of St. Ravino. Now they have reached the plateau the abbey is built upon. Chapter 10. It was mid-afternoon when Carla and her group came out of the jungle and onto the plateau that the abbey was built upon.
"Flat ground at last," Clegg muttered. "I think my horse was going to die from that climb."
"Your horse is fine," Wick said. "Steady rise, to be sure, but nothing like the quad. Like as not, it's your backside that's glad for the change."
Clegg scowled at him, but said nothing. Grievous took out his telescope and studied the landscape ahead of them.
"The road proceeds north, then goes over a low ridge ahead. Perhaps the abbey is on the other side of that."
"I think so," Carla replied. "Just as Montrose said, we should be there around late afternoon."
"Can't come soon enough for me," the cook said, his sour mood still firmly in place. "The monks are famous for their beer, aren't they?"
"Yes, they are," Carla confirmed. "I'm sure they'll spare you a tankard."
"Only one?" Clegg shook his head. "After that ride, I'll need two to wash the dust out of my mouth."
He frowned.
"We passed by several farms where I could have slaked my thirst. I'd have even paid with my own coin for a pint. You'd think the folk would be more gracious to travelers. The gates leading to their farmsteads all chained up, and no one coming out to pass the news? Why, that one place, the fellow drove his livestock out of the pasture as soon as he saw us."
"I think they've had their fill of travelers coming to call for some time," Carla said. "Another of those farms had a portion of their fence taken down, remember? It looked like someone drove a portion of their herd through it, heading towards the abbey." She sighed. "More of the gracious gift, do you think?"
"Very likely," Grievous replied. "It appears your concerns were correct. Once out of sight of the city, these pilgrims are quite willing to take what they require."
He shook his head.
"As the commissioner said, there were no bandits upon this road, but perhaps that is not because the pilgrims have no coin to steal."
"They haven't driven the bandits off," Wick grumbled. "They've replaced them."
Carla heard the simmering anger in his voice. Wick was taking these discoveries the hardest. His faith in the triad was strong, and to see these crimes being perpetrated in their name by a group he'd long looked up to filled him with shame. She dropped back in the column to ride alongside the guard.
"How are you doing?" she asked.
"I'm all right, mistress," he said after a moment. "Just finding it hard to think about sword priests turned to banditry. If my da were here, like as not I'd be trying to calm him down."
"Well, we're like to see a good deal more of them if they're already up at the abbey," she warned him. "Are you going to be able to keep your temper in check? We don't know what we're going to find up there. Best we avoid trouble."
"I understand, mistress," Wick said. "I'll keep my words behind my teeth."
"I know you will, Wick," she said. "I never doubted it." He gave her a smile and a shrug, then looked around.
"That's funny," Wick said to her, "to think that fellow Strabo rode along this same road as we're riding now."
"He's not the only one," she said. "His Grace said that he spent some time here when he was younger. I'm sure he traveled this road as well."
Wick looked at her. "Did he really?"
Carla nodded, and the guard chuckled.
"I didn't know that."
He seemed at a loss for words.
"Makes you... oh, I don't know. Makes you think, doesn't it?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, those trees over there," the guardsman replied, pointing to a copse less than a mile away, ahead on their left. "They look old enough that they'd have been here when each of them came this way. Maybe a little shorter, but the view would have been much the same for them as it is for us. I'd not presume to imagine what His Grace might have been thinking about while he was passing by, but what was Strabo thinking about?"
He glanced at Grievous a short distance ahead of them and lowered his voice.
"From what you were all saying last night, it wasn't long after this that he took that new name and started flying the black."
He shook his head.
"Makes you think, is all."
"I suppose it does," she answered. She wasn't surprised that when Wick changed the subject from the pilgrims, this was the one he had chosen. Captain Strabo and the man he eventually became had been the subject of most of last night's conversations around the campfire. They'd all been thinking about the tale they'd heard in the tavern that morning, and after the day's ride was done, the camp was set up and they were enjoying a simple meal, they finally began to give voice to those thoughts. Having gotten over his shock at seeing Strabo's name on a tavern sign, Grievous proved to be extremely curious to hear stories about Praetoris Rex.
Carol imagined this was a facet of his study that he'd been unable to pursue in the Empire. Eventually, Carol convinced Clegg to tell one of his favorite stories, how Praetorius Rex had fallen in love with the Princess of Shafur. It was not one of Clegg's best renditions of the tale, however. Grievous interrogated him throughout the story, interrupting him repeatedly in his search for details.
"You still have not explained how this man could have possibly met this woman to fall in love with her in the first place," Grievous had objected. "Do not the sultans in Al-Kef keep their unmarried daughters hidden away?"
"Aye, I heard that as well," Wick added. "I thought they locked them up in towers and didn't let them out until they got married."
"Well, this girl does end up in a tower. Now you're jumping ahead, and I don't know how they met," Clegg said, becoming exasperated.
Carola bit back a smile. The cook was used to telling this story to a crowd of silent sailors, eagerly drinking in every detail, not having to stop and start over and over.
"This story's not about how they met. It's about what Strabo did to win her."
"Praetorius Rex," Grievous corrected firmly.
"Rex? Strabo? Who cares?" Clegg asked. "It's the same man."
Grievous shook his head. "It is not."
Clegg sighed. "Fine, fine. Can you just let me finish this? Ask your questions after."
He resumed his tale. The girl's furious father sealed her up in a tower, and Praetorius Rex, ever the romantic, had gathered up a small fleet to rescue her. Each ship was captained by another famous pirate of that era.
"Let's see. There was four others," Clegg recalled. "Fielders Gray, the Terrandon exile. Corby Masters, the Crow of the Sea, they called him. Then the Thorn, of course, beautiful as she was deadly. And who else? Ah, yes, our old friend Talaska."
"Hey now," Wick said, "Talaska was already retired by then. And anyway, he wouldn't come out of retirement for the man who cheated him at darts."
"Captain Strabo did not cheat," Grievous said firmly. "He did exactly what he said he would do. It is Talaska's fault if he saw only what he wanted to see. But my young friend is correct. Talaska could not be the fourth captain assisting Praetorius Rex on this rescue."
"All right, so it wasn't Talaska," Clegg growled. "You've thrown me off with your damn questions. Let's see, Jenks Farley?"
He threw a quick glance to Carola, who nodded in confirmation.
"Right, it was Jenks Farley," he shouted, eyeing both of them, daring them to comment further.
Clegg went on, detailing the fleet's tactics to draw away the ships guarding the port, then slip around them and take the city by surprise.
"And as the other captains were sacking Shafur, Rex was reunited with his princess, where, as a true pirate of the Freeze, he liberated a bit of her jewelry. Among other things she was all too willing to give up," he added with a wink at Carola, who rolled her eyes.
"You always have to add that last bit, don't you?" she sighed.
"Wait," Wick said, "what else did he take from—"
He trailed off as three sets of eyes came to rest on him. Then he blushed.
"Oh, right."
"Is the story over?" Grievous asked when Carola had stopped laughing. Clegg frowned, expecting applause or at least a compliment from his listeners.
"Aye, that's the tale."
Grievous nodded.
"I am willing to consider the possibility that at least some portion of the tale is accurate."
"Some portion," Clegg snapped. "That's the honest truth, it is."
Grievous gazed levelly at the cook.
"You truly believe that a princess, who has been born and raised in a city that is the center of her family's wealth and power, would willingly surrender her body to a man who attacks that city, her childhood home? Furthermore, I think it reasonable to expect that some portions of that city would be burned to the ground during the looting."
He shook his head.
"In my experience, the scent of ashes on the wind is a poor aphrodisiac."
Clegg snorted.
"He don't take the fun out of things by half, does he?"
"Captain," Carola cut in, "you said you thought some parts of the tale were accurate?"
Grievous brightened. "Yes, it is possible. During my recent research, I have seen maps depicting Shafur and its surrounding coastline. The motivations given for the assault upon this city are of no worth,"
to which Clegg rolled his eyes,
"but the tactics." Grievous nodded with satisfaction. "The tactics are quite sound."
His expression shifted to a rueful smile.
"Brilliant, in fact. It sounds like a variation of a fleet maneuver called luring the mother from her den. The enemy ships guarding a harbor are drawn away, believing that victory is in their grasp. but this creates an opening for other ships to get in behind them, either to destroy the enemy fleet, or in this case, assault the city itself. A very difficult maneuver, requiring expert timing and trust of your fellow captains." He sighed, then looked at Kerla. "Perhaps the Abbey will have a more official record of this attack upon Shafur."
"They might," Kerla ventured. "They're supposed to collect knowledge, but I don't know if military history is a high priority for them. Why do you want to know?"
Grievous was silent for a moment. "The details of the battle would be a fascinating study in and of themselves, but for me, the value is in pinpointing the man's location at a particular moment in time. There are several years between Strabo's departure and the first appearance of Predatoris Rex inside the Empire. It is a period of time that we know nothing about."
"I'm beginning to understand more about your interest in him," Kerla offered. "I've heard my share of tales about Predatoris Rex, many of them told by Clegg here, by the way," she added with a nod to the cook, who grinned at her. "They're fun stories, but Clegg, even you have to admit they've grown in the telling. They sound more like myths, or the deeds of the prophets that you find in the Book of the Triad. Just a little too fantastic to believe, you know?"
Clegg chuckled, ceding the point to her.
"But what Maleta told this morning in the tavern, that was a real story, told by someone who'd been there. And I was impressed."
She leaned back, remembering what she'd heard.
"In the space of 5 minutes, Captain Strabo avenged a dead countryman, outwitted a pirate, and earned the respect of a crowd of foreigners. He didn't even speak their language, and all without shedding a drop of blood."
She laughed.
"A man like that? Hells, I'd join his crew just to see what he does for an encore."
Grievous smiled. "I tracked down several officers and even some sailors who served with Captain Strabo before he was lost to us. Most were reluctant at first to even speak of their former association. This was not surprising, as those associations had often devastated their later careers. But those who would speak with me all had at least one story to tell, very similar to the one we heard today. A dangerous situation, tense, heavy with the expectation of violence. But somehow, Captain Strabo would bring them through that danger, and with such aplomb that those who were with him could not fail to remember that moment for the rest of their lives. For many of them, that moment inspired them to remain in his company as long as they could, to give him their best efforts. They trusted that he was someone worth following."
"Vertu," Kerla said. "That's your people's word for it, isn't it?"
Grievous chuckled. "Indeed. As you said, they wanted to see what he would do next."
"Well, we know that, don't we?"
Clegg laughed. He looked at Grievous, his grin widening as the Sabrian's wistful expression soured.
"So, Captain, what went wrong? He was your folks' golden boy, right? Then he comes up here, and a few years later, you lot had to hunt him down. You're the one who actually killed him, right?"
Wick, who had still been eating, froze in surprise, his fork halfway to his mouth. Kerla got to her feet, ready to step between Grievous and Clegg, when Grievous looked Clegg in the face, and there was something in his expression that froze Clegg's smile.
"Yes, I took his life," Grievous replied, his voice flat, devoid of emotion. "Pirates deserve no other fate."
Clegg's face twitched at that, but otherwise he remained motionless.
"Somehow you have wormed your way into this expedition," the Sabrian went on. "So in the spirit of cooperation, I will answer your question, impolite as it is. I do not know what went wrong, as you have so eloquently put it, so I have decided to find out. It is only proper to learn the value of that which I took."
There was a long silence, broken only by the occasional pop and snap of the campfire. Then Grievous turned away from Clegg and started preparing his bedroll. That had more or less ended the night's conversation. Wick fell asleep not long after that, and Kerla and Clegg kept the first half of the night's watch. Clegg had said very little, staring either into the campfire's waning embers or out into the shadows around them. The group reached the crest of the low ridge and looked ahead of them. A flat expanse of sparse grassland rolled ahead, broken up here and there by copses of trees. The center of the plateau was marked by a steep rise several miles away, upon which they could see high stone walls ringing the top.
"There she is," Wick said as Grievous drew out his telescope. Obviously, Clegg commented.
Clegg, give it a rest, Carolee interjected before Wick could respond. The cook chuckled, saying no more.
The walls are too high to see what is behind them, Grievous said after a long examination, except for one large building at the very crest of the rise.
That'll be the church, Wick said.
Grievous frowned.
I do not believe so. I have seen several of your faith's temples since arriving in the Frieze, and I see none of the slender spires so common to the design. There is one tower rising up from that building, but it reminds me of the observatory tower on the Ducal estate.
I see it, Carla added, not needing the telescope herself. And you're right, it does look like an observatory.
She smiled. Most likely it predates the one back in Kohane.
She spurred her horse forward. Let's see what the rest of the place looks like.
As they rode closer, Carla began to appreciate more elements in the abbey's construction. She realized they were actually approaching the abbey from the back, facing the sloped rise at its highest point, a 100-foot cliff with stone walls rising above that. The road they were on curved around the rise to the left, and while the cliff descended at a relatively constant angle, the abbey's walls did not, but instead stepped down in three separate stages, the lowest stage still rising well over 30 feet above the flat ground surrounding the rise. Wick blew a long whistle as he craned his head up to look at the walls.
How long do you think it took to build those?
Many, many years, Carla answered. I was told this is one of the oldest communities in the Frieze. In fact, the monks were here before the Malakans formally established Maipor as a colony.
They came around a sharper turn where the road bent around an outcropping of rock, and Carla was startled to see movement ahead of them, figures in white. Two men leapt to their feet, staring at her group as they approached. For an instant, she thought they were carrying weapons, but then she realized they were holding farming implements. The pair quickly exchanged words, then one of them ran off, heading further up the road.
"Border patrol?" Wick asked. "For the pilgrims?"
"It would seem so," Carla replied. Before long, they came alongside the remaining pilgrim, who moved off the road and watched them silently as they passed. Carla noted his hollow cheeks and how his eyes glinted from sunken sockets, how they lingered not on their weapons, but on their supplies and horses.
"The pilgrims up here don't seem to eat any better than the newcomers did," she commented.
As they completed the turn, coming around the rise, the noise of the campsite ahead crashed over them. Carla was reminded at first of some of the farmers' markets she'd seen in Terrandor when she was younger, a collection of tents arranged around a central area where people congregated on foot. These markets were seasonal affairs that would often last for an entire week, as farmers and merchants would meet to discuss business, share the latest news, and meet with old friends. Her father had loved to visit these whenever possible, testing his command of the language and picking up fresh supplies, and she had come to associate the memory of the markets with him. The air was hazy in the afternoon sunlight, thick with dust and grit kicked up by the constant tread of feet, the grass long since worn down to bare earth. And the sounds were similar. Most of the voices were speaking Terrandon. But the differences quickly made themselves apparent. The central area was not a full circle, it was a semicircle, clustered around the entrance to the abbey. The tents were of many different sizes and in generally poor condition, repaired so often with whatever was to spare that they resembled patchwork quilts stretched over tent frames. However, if the tents were looking very ramshackle, their layout was not. Unlike the scattered, get-there-first-get-the-best placement of farmers' tents at the Terrandon markets, the pilgrims' tents were arranged in neat rows, with equal spaces of some 3 feet separating each one. The pilgrims were uniformly clad in their formerly white clothing, mostly tunics and leggings, with a few wearing threadbare robes. The ones in the central area were sitting or standing in a cluster, looking weak and showing signs of one illness or another. Some had disfigured limbs or were simply missing one or more altogether. Their voices were raised in prayer, exhorting the triad for salvation. Carla caught the cadence in their unified chant, hearing the influence of the sword priests in the rhythm. There were other pilgrims out beyond the tents, and unlike the crowd here, these pilgrims were engaged in active work.
They seemed healthier than the first group, their movements showing no irregular rhythms of disability, but they appeared no better fed than the patrolmen they had just passed. She saw some buildings in that direction as well, a run-down farmhouse and barn, and some other buildings, such as a stable, that were little better than collapsed ruins. Renovations were underway on the farmhouse, the work being carried out by more of these healthier pilgrims. Others were at work in the grasslands beyond the farm. After another moment, she realized that those grasslands were actually fallow fields that had once been used for growing crops. The pilgrims were clearing the soil, getting the fields ready for planting. To the left of the farmstead and further away from the abbey gate was a short rise where she could see a group of three more tents, along with a new graveyard holding some 30 to 40 fresh mounds of turned earth, and a group of pilgrims digging new graves. "They are making a home for themselves here," Grievous said, looking out at the farmstead and the fields beyond. "Those pilgrims are more active than the unfortunates in front of the gate. Are those more of the sword priests?" "No," Careless said, looking more closely at them. "I guess whatever's wrong with them isn't enough to keep them from working, but they look about as thin and sickly as the rest." Her brow furrowed as she tried to make a count of figures clad in white and gave up. "I didn't think there would be that many people here," she said. 200? 300?
"At least," Wick ventured, "if you count the ones out in the fields, too."
"What's that matter?" Clegg snapped. "They're outside. We want to be inside."
He pointed ahead of them to the walls of the abbey.
"The gate's shut. The monks aren't letting this lot in. How do we convince them to open the door for us?"
Careless stood up in her stirrups to get a better look at the front gate. The walls towered over the pilgrims' camp, and through the dust she could just make out the inscription over the stone archway that led into the gatehouse. "Gather unto thee the knowledge of the world, that ye shall preserve its wisdom for those who come after." She remembered hearing Duke Stephen repeating those words, and the wistful tone in his voice when he spoke of this place. "I wonder what he'd say to see it like this." She noticed that the large group of invalid pilgrims weren't just gathered in the open space before the gate, they were facing it. Their prayers and chants were directed towards the abbey itself. She was about to ask Wick the significance of that when she noticed something else as well. There were four pilgrims making their way through the throng towards them, but she quickly recognized them by their size and bearing as sword priests, and unlike the one who tried to requisition their horses and goods, these were armed with quarterstaves. "We've got company," she warned, dropping back down into her saddle.
"We're attracting attention from other directions as well," Wick said, nodding towards the tents.
There were more of the sickly, underfed pilgrims among them, cooking food or mending torn clothing. These folk were now watching them, too. Carolyn nodded, glancing up to the tops of the walls. There was no sign that anyone from inside the abbey had seen them approach. The sword priests formed a loose line between them and the pilgrims. One of them stepped forward.
"What's your business here with the faithful?" he asked.
His short-cropped hair was blonde, his eyes gray and hard.
"Greetings, brother," Carla replied. "We are escorting a scholar to the abbey," at which Grievous gave a courteous nod to the soldier. "We are here at the abbot's personal request," she added.
The man glanced at Grievous, and his mouth set in a thin line.
"Dismount from the horses and come with us."
"Why?"
The man looked irritated.
"Bringing a Sabrian to this holy place ye are. He's not of the faith. Explain yourself and the purpose of this scholar ye bring with ye."
Carla did not like the sound of that. She pointed toward the abbey's gate.
"Gather unto thee the knowledge of the world, that ye shall preserve its wisdom for those that come after. I think that's all the explanation we need."
The sword priest's jaw clenched. He looked as if he was about to step forward and seize her horse's bridle when there came a rising noise from the crippled pilgrims ahead of them. Looking in their direction, they saw a small wooden door built into the gate swing back, revealing a dark space. Three figures stepped through the opening, wearing dark brown robes, their hoods pulled over their heads. The door began to close behind them as soon as they had passed through it, and the group moved through the throng of pilgrims, some of whom held out their hands to brush and pluck at their robes as they passed. Before the door had completely shut, however, a fourth figure darted out, scrambling after the others. he was not wearing robes, but instead a simple pale shirt and dark pants of rough linen. He was tall and very slender, and as Carla got a better look at him, she realized that he was also young, in his late teens at most. His hair was long, a few shades darker than auburn, and tied back into a tail. He caught up to the monks, staying a few steps behind their group. The monks did not seem to realize that he had followed them. The blonde sword priest scowled at the approaching group and gestured to his fellows. As one, the four shifted their positions from a line to a diamond formation.
"Patrick, you know the agreement?"
one of the monks called out as they neared. He threw his hood back, revealing a man of early middle years, with a thick face, large nose, and bald head, save for a short fringe across the back of his skull.
"No harm in making acquaintances, Hollum," the lead sword priest replied. "Claims they're here on the abbot's request, she does. Is that true? Curious what brings a Sabrian here, though."
He glanced at Grievous.
"That makes what? Two? Three?"
Carla and Grievous shared a surprised look at that.
"How many of them are you allowing inside while keeping the faithful out?"
"Patrick, the agreement is clear," Hollum said, ignoring the question. "You're allowed to make use of the farmstead and fields for as long as you're here, but you're not to block the road."
He glanced behind him, shaking his head at the cluster of pilgrims doing just that,
"or to harass travelers to the abbey."
He spoke as if he was addressing a sulky child.
"Those who hear the father's call are welcome."
"A Sabrian he is," Patrick snapped. "He's not of the faith."
Hollum gave a troubled sigh.
"It is not for us to say who hears the call, Patrick. Remember Aman il-Nasif, who took up the red after a decade of war against the faith?"
"Don't try to lecture me as if I were one of your soft-handed scholars, Hollum. Least of all on matters I know far better than you."
As Hollum gave another sigh, Patrick looked at the travelers again.
"Armed they are," he commented, "and bear their weapons as those who know how to use them."
He studied Wick for a moment.
"You've the look of a Terrandon."
"Born and bred," the guard replied, switching to that language. "Come from a father's match, I do."
Patrick looked surprised.
"Aye?"
He laughed, a wolfish grin crossing his face.
"Common enough when sword priests and bound priests meet. Did your dad train you in the forms?"
"He did," Wick replied.
Patrick nodded in satisfaction, but then a suspicious look came over him.
"So why didn't you put on the tabard yourself?"
Wick looked uncomfortable, but after a moment he chuckled and shrugged.
"I suppose the quad's a bit far off to hear the son's call."
Patrick scowled at him. "Distance is no barrier to the call. Never blame the voice when it's your ears at fault."
Wick flushed. He looked as if he was about to say something, but instead gave Carla a quick glance and held his tongue. Carla smiled at him with a reassuring nod. Patrick, on the other hand, only looked amused at Wick's restraint and now turned to Grievous.
"Best you can get for an escort, is it? What need of these monks for you, anyway?"
Grievous gave the man an amused smile, seeing Patrick's attempt to pick a fight for what it was.
"The Empire is larger than Malachi and Terrandor combined, with a correspondingly greater knowledge of the wider world. I simply bring a portion of it here. One need not be of your faith to respect the mandate carved there," he gestured towards the gate. "Thus, I would say that I heed the father's call. Is it not so?"
Patrick sneered.
"What can a heathen like you teach us?"
"You'd be surprised," the young man behind the monks suddenly called out.
Hollum whipped his head around, stunned to see the youth there.
"Jordan, I told you to stay back."
Carla's mind went blank as the youth gave Hollum a grin that was half apology, half thrill.
"Jordan? This is Jordan? No, Jordan's a little boy. Tesca said..."
Then she realized that Tesca hadn't actually said anything about Jordan's age.
"Why did I assume he would be a little boy? The Duke hasn't left the quad in years. When would he have had the time to come to my poor and father a child?"
She studied the young man as he strode forward. He had the Duke's height and something of his father's face, notably the brilliant blue of his eyes. It looked like he'd inherited his father's chin as well, but it was difficult to be sure. He had a scruff of reddish fuzz that he was trying to groom into a full beard with little success. The biggest difference between them was how they moved. Duke Stephen had a thick frame to match his height and carried himself with a stately, smooth dignity. Jordan, on the other hand, was whip-thin and seemed to bounce with energy as he pointed to Padraic's right arm.
"That scar! Probably got it during a border skirmish against the Kefi, right?"
Padraic raised an eyebrow at that.
"What of it, boy?"
"Looks like a bad cut," Jordan went on. "You could have lost your arm or bled out. I don't see any stitch marks, though. That means you used bind gum to hold the wound closed, didn't you?"
"Aye, bind gum," Padraic said, reluctantly impressed with the observation. "A gift from the sun, praise him."
"Praise him,"
the other three sword priests repeated. Padraic smiled at the chorus.
"Save my arm and countless lives of my brothers, it has. What of it?"
"Very useful stuff," Jordan agreed. "Don't let it get too wet, and it'll keep things in place until stitches can be used. Good in an emergency. Your order's been using it for what, 10, 20 years?
He smiled as Padraic nodded.
"The thing is, it's actually a Sabrian invention. They've been using it for centuries after duels."
He turned to Grievous and spoke in Sabrian.
"Is it not so?"
Grievous blinked, surprised to hear his native tongue, but he nodded in agreement. The young man returned the nod and looked back at Padraic.
"How does it feel to know you and your brothers owe your lives to those heathens?"
He grinned as Padraic's scowl deepened.
"Maybe they have more to teach?"
Padraic flicked his wrist, letting his staff drop across the bridge of Jordan's nose with a sharp crack. Jordan fell back with a yelp, blood spraying out of his nostrils. In the next second, as Padraic was shifting to a two-hand grip on his staff, Kerla flung herself off her horse and tackled him, bringing him to the ground. Padraic recovered from his surprise far more quickly than Kerla had expected. She was trying to wrest the staff from his hands, but he simply pushed the staff up away from him, lifting her into the air with it. Sensing what he was going to do next, she sent a quick entropy spell into the staff as Padraic twisted his body. His intention was to fling her to one side, perhaps roll on top of her as well, but the brittle staff came apart in his hands as he flexed the wood, and she crashed back down on top of him, knocking the wind out of his chest. Thinking fast, Kerla jabbed her index finger under Padraic's jaw, letting her fingernail dig into his flesh. Padraic froze, locking eyes with her.
"Didn't see you draw a knife," he said.
"Didn't see me tackle you either," she replied. "Now, we can keep going if you want. Your friends will kill me, but I'll have opened your throat, and bind gum won't save you from that. Or we part ways here. It's your choice."
Several seconds ticked by as the two stared into each other's eyes. Then Padraic gave her a rough grin.
"Fair enough, girl. Accept your terms, I do."
"Swear it."
Padraic nodded and spoke in a loud voice that carried to his fellows.
"Swear upon the sword and shield, I do. This fight is over."
"Wick," Kerla called.
"He won't break that oath, mistress," the guard replied.
She had expected to hear his voice from further away, still on his horse, but he was much closer, standing almost directly over her, his sword drawn and watching the other three sword priests, who had their staves raised, ready to strike. Kerla nodded and carefully lifted herself off of Padraic, who remained perfectly still, waiting until she was on her feet again before standing himself. The sword priest looked at Kerla's empty hand, and his grin widened.
"Nice trick, girl. But if we dance again, best really have a knife in that hand."
"Oh, I will," she said with a wink. "Until that next dance, the triad keep you safe."
"And you," Padraic replied as he dusted himself off.
Then, as he started looking at the ground around him, his expression turned puzzled.
"Back on the horse, Wick," Kerla said, tugging on Wick's sleeve.
"What's he doing?"
the guard asked in a low voice as he turned to follow her.
"Looking for the remains of his staff," she replied. "Let's get out of here before he begins to wonder what happened to it."
Wick made a humorless chuckle as he swung up into his saddle. Kerla stepped up to Hollum, who was kneeling down examining Jordan. The youth was sitting up, slowly shaking his head, and was holding the sleeve of his shirt over his broken nose.
"How is he?" she asked.
Hollum made the same weary sigh he had when speaking to Padraic. He eased Jordan's arm away from his face and gently put his fingers on both sides of Jordan's nose.
"A clean break, at least. You should make a full recovery once we reset it."
"How do we do that?"
Jordan began in a thick voice, but without warning, Hollum shifted his fingers, popping the disjointed nose back into place. Jordan gave a surprised howl of pain.
"It's done," Hallam said. "A splint to keep everything in place, and you should be fine before you know it. Does it hurt less now?"
Jordan gave the monk a sullen glare, but nodded. Hallam gave him a gentle smile.
"Let that be a lesson to you, lad. Not all who hear the truth will be grateful for it."
He looked at Kerla.
"My thanks to you for resolving the situation."
Kerla smiled at that, then glanced over her shoulder. Padraic and one of the other sword priests were examining the shards and splinters of Padraic's staff, wondering at the dry rot that ran through each piece. "Are we ready to go?" Hallam nodded and stood up, pulling Jordan to his feet as well.
"Best not to delay further."
Kerla got back on her horse and let the monks lead them towards the front gate. The infirm pilgrims, sensing that the door in the gate would be opening soon, began to stir. Those with crutches were struggling upright and beginning to follow their group, and even those unable to walk were starting to pull themselves along the ground in their wake. She turned to Brother Hallam, who was walking ahead of her, her horse's reins in his hand. "They want to get inside?"
"Desperately," Hallam said with a sad smile, "though there is nothing within that would be of any value to them."
He shook his head.
"This is neither the time nor the place to speak of it."
They reached the gate, but the pilgrims who were closest to it had already begun to cluster around the door, knowing that it would have to open to let the monks back inside.
"Please, please," one of the invalids close to Kerla was saying, "take me in with you."
He reached up towards her with a trembling, withered hand.
"I don't think I can," Kerla said, cringing slightly as Hallam gently but firmly moved the man's hand back. "I'm sorry, I truly am."
"Please,"
the man repeated. Kerla wasn't sure if he'd heard a word of what she just said. Behind them, both Wick and Clegg were being crowded by the pilgrims, just as she was, but she was surprised to see that Grievous was given a wide berth.
"They're afraid to touch him," she realized. "They're afraid to even get near him."
But that was not the same as ignoring him. Many of the pilgrims who recoiled as Grievous drew close fixed him with furious, resentful glares as he passed.
"You'll have to get down from the horses and lead them through the door," Hallam said.
Kerla got down and took the reins back as the door in the gate swung in, revealing a dark space. She felt Hallam's hand on the small of her back, but she didn't need any prompting as she moved towards the opening. The horse paused before entering, but then seemed to decide that the darkness ahead was preferable to the pressing crowd behind, and followed Kerla through the opening with only a few tugs on the reins. Her fellows did as Kerla had done, while the three monks and Jordan formed an aisle with their bodies, keeping the pilgrims away from the door itself so the travelers could get inside. Kerla's eyes quickly grew accustomed to the dark. She was in a short tunnel with a stone ceiling arcing some 10 feet above her head. Another wooden door of similar design to the first blocked off the other end of the tunnel.
"Move down to the other door, mistress," came a voice behind her, and she turned to see another monk standing behind the door, waiting to push it closed. "It's going to get crowded in here shortly."
Kerla nodded, understanding what the monk meant. "They're not going to open the second door until the first one's closed." As she moved her horse down the tunnel, Clegg was the next to come through, tugging his horse behind him, followed in short order by Grievous, then Wick. The door began to shut as soon as Wick's horse was clear, but Jordan and the monks darted through the narrowing gap, Hallam coming last, his foot clearing the space just before the door thudded shut. This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. Also, if you're looking to add another podcast or two to your collection, here's one you might like. For great short stories of literary adventure fantasy, check out the Beneath Ceaseless Skies audio fiction podcast, a 2-time Parsec Award finalist, featuring short stories from the Hugo Award finalist online magazine Beneath Ceaseless Skies. To hear over 100 fantasy stories by authors such as Marie Brennan, Saladin Ahmed, and Richard Parks, read by Parsec Award finalist readers such as Rajan Khanna, Tina Connolly of Toasted Cake, and John Maher, look for Beneath Ceaseless Skies on iTunes or visit beneath-ceaseless-skies.com. And if you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode,
please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.